vous remercions d'être venus aussi nombreux. Et nous allons continuer le travail de la semaine précédente sur le rôle néfaste, si j'ai bien compris, de la politique américaine.
J'utilise pas le mot, mais...
dans le pseudo-processus de paix. Voilà, je te cède la parole tout de suite.
Merci bien, Henri. Comme j'ai dit, la première semaine, je vais parler en anglais, mais je peux prendre des questions, bien sûr, en français après. C'est plus facile pour moi de faire au moins des conférences en anglais, bien que je peux répondre. Bon, in my first lecture, I set out some of the background to the relationships between the United States, between Israel, and the Palestinians over a period going back to President Truman. And today, I'm going to go into what I call the first real moment where important elements of this relationship were laid down, and tracks were created on which everything has rolled since then. So today's lecture represents the first of the what I regard as three important moments in the development of the structures that exist today as between the United States, Israel, and the Palestinians. I'm going to begin with a quote from the Likud Party platform, which was issued in March 1977, just before the elections that brought Menachem Begin to power. The right of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is eternal and indisputable and is linked with the right to security and peace. Therefore, Judea and Samaria will not be handed over to any foreign administration. Between the sea and the Jordan River, there will be only Israeli sovereignty. Relinquishing parts of the Western land of Israel, this is a term of art, you have to know the revisionist political philosophy which argued that Jordan is part of Palestine and therefore part of the land of Israel. So when they say the Western land of Israel, they mean essentially mandatory Palestine west of the Jordan River. Relinquishing parts, I'm returning to the document, relinquishing parts of the Western land of Israel undermines our right to the country, unavoidably leads to the establishment of a, quote, Palestinian state, unquote, jeopardizes the security of the Jewish population, endangers the security of the state of Israel, and frustrates any prospect of peace. This was the platform on which Begin was elected. This is the basis of everything that has happened since then, 1977, 35 years ago. Keep this in mind as we go through what happened in the following couple of years. American presidents, from Truman down to President Obama, have consistently hewed to the pattern that I explored in my first lecture. This pattern involved pandering to Israel and its American supporters and evincing unconcern about inalienable Palestinian rights. This was the case in spite of occasional tepid statements of American support for Palestinian rights that were offered by President Carter and by other presidents after him. There were a few rare occasions when the US government offered an official endorsement of Palestinian rights. However, if such an endorsement was issued, and if it was not quickly withdrawn or modified, as usually happened, this was never in the context of parity or on a basis of complete equality with Israel. In other words, rights for Palestinians were never put on the same basis as rights for Israelis. And they were never put forward, if they were endorsed by a US president, without debilitating conditions. It's true that for decades, the United States supported annual reiterations by the UN General Assembly of the important principles of refugee return and compensation that were embodied in Resolution 194 that was passed back in 1948, although after the Clinton administration, the United States started abstaining from such resolutions. And then from 1998 onwards, the United States started voting against refugee return and compensation in the General Assembly. However, that was refugee rights. Palestinian political and national rights were not even mentioned by American policymakers between 1948 and 1967. these rights were ignored entirely in what became the foundation for Middle East peacemaking, the UN Security Council Resolution 242, which was passed on November 22, 1967. Although 242 referred to, quote, the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, it simply spoke of, quote, a just settlement of the refugee problem without even specifying the Palestinians by name. Mention of Palestinian national rights in the context of US policy or of UN resolution was actively opposed by the next few US administrations, right down to Jimmy Carter. Now, Carter was elected in 1976, was inaugurated in January 1977, and it briefly appeared as if he might be an exception to this rule. A few months after his inauguration, Carter was the first US president to speak of the need for a, quote, Palestinian homeland. And his administration alluded to political rights for the Palestinians by suggesting permitting, and I quote again, self-determination by the Palestinians in deciding their future status. While this circumlocution was not by any means a call for full Palestinian self-determination or statehood, the wording represented an advance on previous American formulations, at least since 1947, when the United States voted for a resolution which would have created a Palestinian national state in part of Palestine. This statement, talking about a Palestinian homeland and talking about self-determination by the Palestinians in deciding their future status, aroused the ire of partisans of the status quo in the Middle East, among them the Israeli government. The administration then further infuriated the newly elected right-wing liquid cabinet of Begin, which came to power in May 1977, and provoked a firestorm among American supporters of Israel by agreeing to a joint communique on the Middle East with the Soviet Union on October 1st, 1977. This is a very interesting and very rare document. The United States and the Soviet Union came to an agreement on how to go forward in the Middle East peace process in a way which actually was almost unique. There had been a previous Geneva conference co-sponsored by the United States and the Soviet Union in January 1974. There was to be a conference at Madrid, which I'll talk about in my next lecture. But this communique stands out in a number of ways. However, that the United States should consider bringing the Soviet Union, the patron of the Arabs and supporter of the PLO, into Middle East peacemaking was bad enough in the eyes of Israel and of Israel's supporters in the United States and of American anti-Soviet hardliners. These two groups, supporters of Israel and a strong anti-Soviet trend, were coming gradually closer together at this time with the rise of what we later come to call neoconservatism. Worse in the eyes of both groups, supporters of Israel and hardline anti-communists, the joint communique spoke not just of, quote, legitimate Palestinian interests, which was the standard mealy-mouthed American formulation up to this point. It spoke rather of the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people, which clearly implied that the Palestinians had national rights, including self-determination and statehood. The communique referred as well to participation by representatives of, quote, the Palestinian people in a reconstituted and reconvened Geneva peace conference. So this was the American-Soviet joint communique of October 1st, 1977. The resulting furor, and it was one of those tempests in a teapot which only Washington is capable of, the resulting furor that this communique produced caught the Carter administration by surprise. They had no idea what was about to hit them. In clear disarray, Carter and his advisors quickly backed down and quickly disowned much of what they had just attempted to put forward together with the Soviets. Only a couple of days later, after the issuance of this communique, Secretary of State Cyrus Vance was obliged to issue a joint US-Israeli working paper together with Israeli Foreign Minister Moshe Dayan, who had flown to Washington to read the Riot Act to the Americans. This new working paper repudiated every new position which had been set out in the US-Soviet joint communique regarding the Palestinians. Basically, the United States, in a stroke of the pen in this working paper, negated everything it had agreed upon after several months of negotiations with the Soviets. American policymakers thereafter avoided repeating such forthright terms as legitimate Palestinian rights and the Palestinian people for over a decade and a half. In the meantime, as we're going to see, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat in November 77 had flown to Jerusalem, had given his famous speech to the Israeli Knesset, had upended the entire Middle Eastern scene and had set in motion the events that were to lead to the Camp David Accords and the 1979 Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. Now, in spite of his original willingness to challenge the dominant paradigm where Palestinian national rights were concerned, at Camp David in 1978, when he sat down with Sadat and Begin, President Carter in the end meekly accepted the exceedingly restrictive terms regarding Palestine and the Palestinians that were put forward by Prime Minister Begin. While at the insistence of Egypt, the Camp David Accords mentioned, quote, the legitimate rights of the Palestinian people and their just requirements, the Accords applied only to the minority of Palestinians who lived in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. They thereby left out not only the much larger number of Palestinians who had been driven out of the country in 1948, 1967, were in fact an absolute majority of Palestinians. People living outside of what used to be mandatory Palestine are an absolute majority of the Palestinian people. They also excluded Palestinians who were residents of Jerusalem or who were citizens of the State of Israel. Insultingly, in the Camp David Accords, the quote unquote refugee problem was the only mention of the Palestinians besides their rights in general, was to be dealt with by Israel, Egypt, and, quote, other interested parties. There was no mention in the Camp David Accords of the Palestinians, who presumably could have been petitioned to be considered a party to discussion of this issue that had such existential importance for them. Moreover, the Accords provided for the continuation of military occupation. According to the Camp David Accords, some Israeli forces were to be withdrawn, others were to be subject to redeployment, but were to stay inside the occupied territories, and the Accords did nothing to limit the expansion of Israeli colonization. To add insult to injury, Carter was obliged to acknowledge in a January 22, 1978, side letter to Begin, 5 days after they signed the Camp David Accords, that wherever the expressions Palestinians or Palestinian people occurred in the text, Carter wrote Begin, they are, quote, being and will be construed and understood by you as Palestinian Arabs. Now, again, you have to know something about the language used by, in particular, the revisionists, later Herut, later the Likud party, to understand that Palestinian Arabs is a term of art for those Israelis who denied the peoplehood of the Palestinians. So Carter basically accepted that, as far as Israel was concerned, it had not accepted that there was a people called the Palestinian people. Carter's retreat from the forthright positions he had staked out at the beginning of his administration was a result of what was by now a well-established American reluctance, going back to the time of Truman, to impose things on Israel, mainly because of the kind of domestic political considerations I talked to when I talked about the Truman administration. This reluctance had been strongly reinforced by the Carter administration's humiliating climb down over the U.S.-Soviet joint communique, which served as an object lesson to it and to later U.S. administrations. As a result, we shall see that Begin's narrow legalistic formulations that were produced at Camp David, and in the preparation of these lectures, I've come upon a number of unpublished documents which go in great detail into Begin's position, some of which I'll talk about today. These narrow legalistic formulations produced by Begin, precisely as restrictively as his and subsequent Israeli governments chose to interpret them, in effect have become the practical working basis, not just of Israeli policy, but of U.S. policy, or rather have become the ceiling imposed on U.S. policy through the 1993 Oslo Accords and right down to the present day. So what I'm going to try and lay out for you today is how Begin envisioned autonomy for the Palestinians, how that became the basis not just of Israeli policy, not just at Camp David, but ever since, and also, in effect, the ceiling on what the United States allowed itself to do. Now, the Egyptian-Israeli Camp David Accords, which were negotiated under the auspices of the United States, in addition to providing for peace between Egypt and Israel, provided for negotiations for the establishment of what was called a self-governing authority for the population of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Jerusalem, Palestinian Arab inhabitants of occupied Arab East Jerusalem were excluded from the provisions of the Camp David Accords, and they stipulated, quote, full autonomy for the inhabitants, but did not apply to the land. And we'll see how Begin envisioned this, which was to remain under full Israeli control. So the inhabitants were to have autonomy. The land was not, the status of the land, of the occupied territories themselves, was not to change under Camp David. A peace treaty between Egypt and Israel that was based on these accords was signed in 1979, and Israel thereafter began a withdrawal of its forces from occupied Egyptian territory, the occupied Sinai, which was completed in the spring of 1982. However, the Palestinian autonomy accords were a continuing source of dispute between all three signatories, as well as with the Palestinians themselves, and in the end, these accords were never implemented. We're going to look at them nevertheless because they were important. Now, the negotiation of these accords, as you probably know, had entirely excluded the PLO, which was by this point already the recognized representative of the Palestinians, in keeping with the preference of all three parties to Camp David, the United States, Israel, and Egypt. And I'm going to explain why each was opposed. Each of them had its own reasons for the exclusion of the chosen representatives of the Palestinians, who are the people who were supposedly most concerned by Israel's occupation of their territory. The United States, firstly, still officially considered the PLO a terrorist organization in 1978-79, although it had maintained clandestine security and political contacts with PLO representatives in Beirut for several years. This was a blatant violation of explicit commitments the United States had made to Israel. Originally, Secretary of State Kissinger had made these commitments in 1974, committing the United States not to have anything to do with the PLO unless it met a number of Israeli desiderata. While, as we've seen, the rhetoric of American policy, as enunciated both by President Carter and later by President Reagan, came to include recognition that the Palestinians had some legitimate rights, these rights only went so far as the United States was concerned. In practice, the United States would not allow those who were universally recognized to speak for the Palestinians to take part in freely enunciating these rights or in negotiations or in an otherwise determining their future as a people. In spite of the beginning of a formal US-PLO dialogue in the final year of the Reagan administration in 1988, this US policy of not accepting that the Palestinians could choose their own representatives for international negotiations on their fate did not change for another decade and a half after Camp David. It was only finally abandoned after an Israeli government headed by Yitzhak Rabin began to negotiate directly with the PLO in 1993. So when the Israelis did it, it became kosher, and the United States allowed itself to do the same thing. Now, that's why the United States objected to the PLO. Needless to say, the PLO was anathema to the Begin government that had come to power in 1977. Like its Labor Party predecessors, the Likud government denied the very existence of the Palestinians as a people with national rights, or that there was any longer such a thing as Palestine. You all remember Golda Meir's famous statement to the Sunday Times. There was no such thing as Palestinians. This is back in 1969. There was no such thing as Palestinians. When was there an independent Palestinian people with a Palestinian state? It was either southern Syria before the First World War, and then it was Palestine, including Jordan. It was not as though there was a Palestinian people in Palestine considering itself as a Palestinian people, and we came and threw them out and took their country away from them. They did not exist. This was not a Likud position. This was a wall-to-wall Israeli position at this time, Labor Party as well as the Likud. Begin and his colleagues, however, had specific views that went beyond this. They were disdainful of Palestinian claims to any part of the country, notably the West Bank, which they considered the core of the land of Israel, of Eretz Israel. They insisted on calling the West Bank by its long disused antique name, biblical name, of Judea and Samaria, treating the PLO, of course, as no more than a terrorist organization representing no legitimate cause because of its acts of violence against Israelis and others, was an exceedingly useful device to enable Israel to avoid having to deal with the uncomfortable reality of the Palestinians and their national claims. This demonization of the entire Palestinian people because of accusations that it engaged in terrorism was particularly piquant in the case of Begin and his successor as Prime Minister, Yitzhak Shamir. As you probably know, both of them had been widely considered as terrorists themselves, in fact, as notorious terrorist masterminds during the British Mandate, although they, of course, regarded themselves as freedom fighters. Finally, I've talked about why the United States and Israel objected to the PLO. But let me talk about Egypt. In spite of his unfailing lip service to the Palestinian cause, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat himself had long preferred to deal with Israel directly and without the encumbrance represented by any of his Arab brethren, most of all the Palestinians themselves. As early as the spring of 1971, this is newly revealed American documents have given us a great deal of background on this 1971 initiative by Sadat. As early as the spring of 1971, barely 6 months after he came to power after Abd al-Nasser's death, Sadat had been rebuffed by Israel when, via the intermediary of U.S. Secretary of State William Rogers, he offered the Israelis essentially the exact same separate peace deal that he negotiated 7 years later at Camp David. In 1971, Sadat offered Israel exactly the deal that it got in 1978. The only difference is tens of thousands of people were killed in the 73 war in the interval. Why did this not happen? It happened firstly because Rogers was undermined by the opposition to such a deal of his own president, President Nixon, and Nixon's then security, national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, because this deal did not explicitly include the expulsion of the Soviet Union from Egypt. As far as Kissinger and Nixon were concerned, getting the Russians out of Egypt was much more important than peace between the Arabs and the Israelis. And they turned this down for that reason. In any case, the government of Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir spurned Sadat's proposal. She turned it down. Sadat's offer, I would stress, in 1971, included no provisions at all for the Palestinians or for ending the occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. Having failed in 1971 to convince the Israeli or American governments to accept his explicit offer of a separate peace with Israel, and after he made several other futile efforts in this direction, Sadat eventually saw that he had no alternative but to go to war in 1973. Even then, in the opening weeks of this war, of the 1973 war, Sadat had betrayed his Syrian allies, having assured them in military conversations that his troops would push much further east into Sinai than they actually did. They thereby left the exposed Syrian forces on the Golan Heights to bear alone the brunt of an Israeli counterattack. The Israelis left the Egyptians in place, focused entirely on the Syrians. This offensive was backed by the entirety of the Israeli Air Force. They flew no sorties over Sinai while they were driving the Syrians back in the Golan Heights, contributing to a near rout of the Syrian forces. The reason I mention this is because Sadat's intention to act alone had been made manifest long before he went to Jerusalem in 1977. The way he ran the 73 war was already evidence of this. As soon as possible after the war began in 1973, Sadat began separate negotiations with Israel via the intermediary of Secretary Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy and negotiated the first of two Sinai disengagement agreements, one in 1973 and one in 1975. Sadat was hoping, and his Arab allies feared, that continuation of this process would lead rapidly to a separate peace with Israel, the same deal that he tried to get in 1971. Sadat was thus extremely dissatisfied with signs that the newly inaugurated Carter administration in early 77 was unwilling to continue on the path charted by Kissinger's disengagement agreements towards a separate Israeli-Egyptian bilateral peace. Sadat was particularly frustrated that the new administration instead appeared to be trying to address the concerns of all parties, not just those of Egypt and Israel. When the joint communique of October 1st was issued, the joint American-Soviet communique, showing that the Carter team was actually trying to launch comprehensive negotiations with all the parties to the Arab-Israeli conflict in collaboration with the Soviet Union, Sadat exploded and took action. As his behavior as far back as 1971 had shown, what the Egyptian president wanted was a separate peace with Israel and a privileged relationship with the United States. He did not want to drag along all his fractious Arab brethren. He did not want to deal any further with the Soviet Union in any guise. He was fed up, of course, with the Russians by this point. After clandestine negotiations between his representatives and those of Begin in Morocco, Sadat paid this famous visit to Jerusalem, which led to the Camp David Accords and the peace treaty that I've already begun talking about. I would stress that for all of the merits of this peace treaty between Egypt and Israel, far from ending the entire conflict, this step heralded more violence in Lebanon. It was followed by the 1982 Israeli invasion. It heralded more violence inside Palestine, and it heralded an intensification of the conflict, which has now been ongoing for 35 years. So you can say whatever you want to say about Egypt and Israel. It did bring peace on the Egyptian-Israeli front. It did allow the return of Sinai to Egypt. It did not bring peace to the Middle East. There were many reasons why the Autonomy Accords that had been negotiated between Sadat and Begin at Camp David had been stillborn. Two of these reasons were the exclusion of the Palestinians' chosen representatives from Camp David and the PLO's subsequent boycott of a process which they saw as violating their inalienable rights by imposing autonomy under continued Israeli occupation as a ceiling on what they could aspire to. So one of the reasons that these autonomy accords never worked was that the Palestinians were kept out and they opposed them from the outside. Another reason was Sadat's near total isolation in the Arab world as a result of his making a separate peace with Israel. What he had thereby done was to abandon the Arab countries which had fought with Egypt in the 73 war and severely alienated them. Following that war, the Arab countries that had aligned with Israel, including the PLO, by the way, had hoped for a comprehensive multilateral peace effort with Israel on the basis of Security Council resolutions and hopefully with the involvement of the Soviets, who they saw as less biased in favor of Israel. They hoped that such an effort would follow the lines of the abortive Geneva peace conference. Actually, it was December 1973. It wasn't January 74, that brief meeting of a Geneva peace conference. Instead of getting a Geneva conference, instead of getting the Soviets, instead of getting a comprehensive approach, from 74 to 76, they got the Kissinger-brokered separate agreements that weakened the position of the Soviet Union in the region, that reinforced the mutual suspicions of many of the Arab states, and that set Egypt well on the way to a separate peace with Israel under U.S. auspices, which was Sadat's great desire. Most Arabs had been elated in October 77 when the Carter administration revived the prospect of a multilateral international conference. I was in Beirut at the time, and I remember everybody said, oh my God, we actually may have a settlement. There actually may be a negotiation. They were shocked when Sadat soon afterwards, well, they were shocked by the American withdrawal of all the positions it had taken, and they were further shocked in the Arab world when Sadat flew to Jerusalem to cut out the insufficiently enthusiastic American middleman and to deal directly with the Israelis. Now, while Sadat was willing to sign a separate peace, his discomfort and the discomfort of Egyptian elites at the president's isolation in the Arab world caused Sadat to be reluctant to go along with the Begin government's insistence on an interpretation of the Camp David Accords, which was extremely restrictive regarding the Palestinians. Taking such a step, accepting Begin's interpretation of Camp David, Sadat estimated, would have embarrassed him further with his Arab brethren. Nevertheless, Sadat never allowed problems on the Palestinian autonomy track to block his headlong normalization of relations with Israel or his honeymoon with Washington. He disagreed with Begin over how to interpret Camp David, but that did not stop him from normalizing with Israel and from cuddling up to the American government. In spite of his unctuous cooperation with almost everything the United States asked him to do, Sadat was not helped by the inability or the unwillingness of the administrations of both President Carter and Ronald Reagan to weigh in with support of the Egyptian position. And in the American documents that I've seen, American analysts, as we're going to see, say, you know, the United States could take a position with Egypt on this, but what you'll see again and again is the United States ending up aligning itself with Begin. Now, there was a big change with the arrival in power of the Reagan administration in January 1981. The Reagan administration was ideologically much more predisposed towards alignment with Israel than had been that of Carter. It therefore was even less inclined to put pressure on Israel. This was in part because of its hardline anti-Soviet posture, into which Israel fitted perfectly as the main local opponent of so-called Soviet clients like Syria or the PLO. In addition, Israeli leaders like Begin and Ariel Sharon, who held different positions in Begin's government, eventually becoming defense minister, both of them and other Israeli ministers constantly played on the Reagan administration's strong ideological predispositions, with regular references to the danger of state-sponsored international terrorism to the free world. Begin loved to use these kinds of terms, in effect bringing the United States and Israel closer together on ideological grounds. The ranks of the Reagan administration were filled with neoconservatives, people who had previously been Democrats and who became right-wing Republicans, people like Eugene Rostow, who were both fiercely anti-Soviet and quite outspokenly pro-Israel, and who served to bring the American and Israeli positions closer in a number of ways. Rostow had served the Johnson administration. His name was Eugene Debs Rostow, named for the great American socialist leader. His brother was Walt Whitman Rostow. All of the Rostows were named for left-wing icons in American public life. But Eugene Rostow moved over to the far right by this time, and he was therefore a classic case of neoconservatism. As a dogged defender of Israel's policy of establishing settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, it was Rostow who was the legal advisor to the State Department at this time, who concocted the legal argument that the Fourth Geneva Convention on Occupied Territories did not apply to the occupied Palestinian territories, and that they therefore were not occupied. A great feat of legal reasoning for a man who'd served as the dean of the law school at Yale University. This led eventually, it had an impact. It led the Reagan administration to cease describing Israeli settlements as illegal, which every president since Johnson had done. Now, they were only seen as an obstacle to peace, another one of those lovely American euphemisms that we should all cherish. This has been the official U.S. position under every subsequent president. So Rostow had a nefast effect, even though he only served Ronald Reagan. In the wake of the replacement of the militantly pro-Israel Secretary of State, Alexander Haig, by George Shultz, in June 1982, at the height of Israel's invasion of Lebanon, and following the subsequent defeat of the PLO during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the Reagan administration decided to shift course. So Reagan came into office ideologically predisposed to be supportive of Israel for reasons having to do with the Cold War and the Soviet Union, but also reasons having to do with the sympathies for Israel of many of the leading figures in the administration. But during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, several things changed. One of them was that the president believed he'd been deceived by Haig. I have been given a document by a student of mine which describes the last meeting between Secretary Haig and Israeli Defense Minister Ariel Sharon on May 25th, 1982, which reveals that the United States didn't just give Israel a green light to invade Lebanon. It gave Israel an engraved invitation to invade Lebanon. I mean, you read the discussion in the notes of Charlie Hill between Haig and Sharon, and it's perfectly clear that Haig is telling him, go right ahead, do whatever you want. This was apparently not shared with the president, and the president came to resent it. So the Reagan administration shifted course in the middle of the war in Lebanon and decided to launch a new Middle East peace initiative. This decision was the result of a reassessment of the situation in the region by the president's closest advisors, notably his new Secretary of State, George Shultz. Now, Shultz, who had the confidence of Ronald Reagan until the end of the Reagan presidency, Shultz and his subordinates at the State Department were disaffected from Israel because of the brutality of the Israeli siege and bombardment of Beirut, as in fact was President Reagan. He was a man who didn't pay a lot of attention to foreign affairs, but he watched television. And watching the bombardment of Beirut seriously affected the president. I assume he read some of the reports he was getting, but certainly what he was seeing on TV was more than enough. All of them, the president and his advisors, perceived that it was essential for the United States to take advantage of the conjuncture resulting from the Israeli invasion to push through a resolution to the Arab-Israeli conflict that would cement America's paramount influence throughout the Middle East. So they wanted to take advantage of this situation. Among the elements of this conjuncture were the grave weakening of the position of the PLO in Syria, as well as their leftist allies in the Lebanese National Movement, after all of them had been defeated by Israel in the preceding months, and also the increase as a result in the influence of Israel in the region. It was an even greater military power than it had been before. An additional factor, was the fact that at this time, both Iran and Iraq were almost totally distracted by their savage fratricidal war. So for all these reasons, the Reagan administration decided to launch an initiative. The decision to launch this initiative came partly in response to pressure for a resolution of outstanding aspects of the Arab-Israeli conflict after the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty from the United States' Arab allies. This was especially the case for the Saudi monarchy, which more than 30 years after its founder, Ibn Saud, had broached the matter with President Roosevelt, as we talked about in my last lecture last week. Now the Saudis finally hope to see the Palestinian issue finally put to rest on an acceptable basis. To that end, in 1981, the Saudis had issued their first peace plan in the name of then Crown Prince Fahd ibn Abdulaziz Al Saud, the so-called Fahd Plan. Schultz, who had spent the 8 years before he became Secretary of State working for the Bechtel Corporation, had extensive experience in dealing with Saudi Arabia, which was a lucrative market for Bechtel. They built almost every military base in Saudi Arabia over several decades, and much else. All around, it seemed a perfect moment for the Reagan administration, which had revived the Cold War rhetoric and outlook of the 50s and 60s, to capitalize on the victory of its ally, Israel, over what it saw as three Soviet proxies in Lebanon. Days before the Reagan plan was issued, however, on August 24th, 1982, the Reagan plan was issued on September 1st when the president gave a speech. But days before the issuance of the plan, a confidential National Intelligence Council memo entitled, quote, U.S.-Israeli differences over the Camp David peace process was produced for the director of Central Intelligence. The entire document is now available. Parts of it are redacted, but it's almost available in its entirety. This document laid out in precise detail for U.S. policymakers the extraordinarily restrictive interpretation placed by the Begin government, and in fact every government that followed it in Jerusalem, on the concept of Palestinian autonomy. This document also revealed how daunting would be the task of the Reagan administration and its successors down to the present day in trying to put forward a credible plan that would resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict by ending Israel's occupation and halting Israeli settlement expansion, both of which Begin was committed to continuing. The final outcome of this showdown, which of course was in Begin's favor, hinted at the complicity or the complaisance or the political cowardice that would be shown by American administrations in trying to overcome obstacles raised by Begin and his successors, whether this was in the 80s, what we're talking about today, whether it was in the 90s, what I'll talk about next week, or whether it was in the second decade of the 21st century under President Obama, which I will talk about in my last lecture. Now, the perceptive CIA analyst, he probably was the National Intelligence Officer for the Middle East. He probably, I think I know who he was actually, probably was Graham Fuller. I'll ask him one day. The perceptive CIA analyst, he probably can't tell me, but I'll ask him anyway. The perceptive CIA analyst who was responsible for this memo, and his name is redacted, so we don't really know, was blunt in laying out the Israeli Prime Minister's bottom line. Now, I'm quoting from this memo. Begin asserts that the Camp David Accords rule out the emergence of a Palestinian state. And keep in your minds the Likud Party program that I read to you at the very beginning of this lecture. Begin asserts that the Camp David Accords rule out the emergence of a Palestinian state. In Begin's view, the agreements, and there's a quotation here in the text, guarantee that under no condition can a Palestinian state be created. Not temporarily, permanently. In practice, Begin effectively rules out any exercise of Palestinian self-determination except one that continues Israel's preeminent position in the West Bank. That's the first passage in this document. Now, this is a striking assertion by this American analyst, and it is accurate in every respect as a reflection not only of the views of Begin and his government, but in fact of the enduring position of every Israeli government since then. It's also accurate as a reflection of the outcome thus far of the entire 21-year process that began in Madrid in 1991. I'll talk about that next week. It's notable that these conditions were meant by Begin to apply, and indeed still do apply, not only to the short interim period foreseen in Camp David and Oslo, but indefinitely. This is Begin's view on the situation forever. Now, I'm going to go back to the document. The CIA analyst further argued that, quote, there is no reason to accept Israeli arguments that the United States is prohibited from putting forth its own interpretations of the Camp David Palestinian autonomy provisions. There's no reason that the United States can't actually say that it has a different position from Israel, is what this guy's saying. In other words, see the strange construction. However, this analyst's assessment of the many crippling conditions and restrictions that Begin would insist on placing on Palestinian autonomy indicated that these would not be easy arguments to refute. He noted accurately, and again I'm quoting from the document, Begin's view is that the self-governing authority that was supposed to be set up under Camp David should be a solely administrative authority, regulating the affairs of the Arab inhabitants and leaving control of the territory and all key security issues with Israel. In sum, autonomy is for people, not territory, and therefore does not prejudice Israel's territorial claims to the West Bank. Again, this was a faithful rendition of Begin's views and of the structure of the accords that were later negotiated by Rabin and other Israeli governments that produced the Palestinian Authority. So when you think of the Palestinian Authority today, think of how Begin envisaged Palestinian autonomy back in 1978. The CIA memo explained further, and this is going to be my last long quote from this document. I'm quoting, "Israel has already defined its views on all the key issues and in each case makes a narrow interpretation. One, Jewish settlements are to remain under Israeli control and not be subject to the self-governing authority. The self-governing authority could not prevent new settlements and territorial expansion of existing ones," which has happened ever since. Two, water rights would be allocated by joint Israel self-governing authority agreement. If agreement is not reached, the status quo, which benefits Israel, prevails. Still the situation. Three, land rights would also be under joint control. Israel currently controls a third of West Bank land. This is in the document. And again, failing an agreement, the status quo continues. Status quo benefited Israel. Fourth, security issues, internal and external, would be under sole Israeli control, with only minor police rights given to the self-governing authority. Fifth and finally, East Jerusalem is not considered part of the West Bank, and its Arab inhabitants are not eligible to vote for the self-governing authority. Now, in my view, three things leap out from this extraordinarily prescient CIA assessment. The first is that in keeping I mean, the United States had some very smart people working for it. And the fellow who wrote this really knew what he was doing. The first thing that leaps out from this is that in keeping with the principles enunciated by the Likud Party in its electoral manifesto of March 1977, this schema is meant to preclude permanently any form of real Palestinian national self-determination. That's Begin's objective. This is clear from handwritten notes written by Begin in Hebrew and in English, which he used to prepare for the Camp David summit and which a student of mine has found in the Begin archives in Israel. They conclude, these handwritten notes, it's in Begin's handwriting, they're in the papers of his chef de cabinet in the Begin archives. They conclude with what is called a, quote, unilateral declaration by Israel. That's what Begin titles it. He titles it Unilateral Declaration by Israel. This part is in English. And it goes as follows. These are his own notes for himself at Camp David. Quote, "Under no circumstances will Israel permit the establishment in Judea, Samaria, and the Gaza district, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, of a, quote, Palestinian state. Such a state would be a mortal danger to the civilian population of Israel and a grave peril to the free world." He loved to talk about the free world. So that's the first thing that leaps out. The second thing that leaps out is that the Israeli position on most of these core issues of its relationship with the Palestinians in the context of Palestinian autonomy has not changed in any significant respect under more than half a dozen Israeli governments of every political stripe over nearly 35 years. This was Begin's position, but this has been the position of really every single Israeli government ever since. There has been near total continuity in this regard, with most of the differences mere matters of detail. The third thing that leaps out is that in practice, it has been this intransigent Israeli position that has in the end defined virtually every important outcome in the West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem over that entire period. In other words, this is what has defined reality for 35 years. Not what American presidents said, not what subsequent Israeli prime ministers may have said. The only thing that took place under the various Israeli-Palestinian-Israeli accords that were signed in the 1990s that differed in any significant manner from Begin's schema is that under the Oslo Accords, signed in 1993, Israel eventually did allow East Jerusalem residents to vote in elections for the Palestinian Legislative Council. However, if you actually look at Israeli policy since 1991, it has systematically worked to detach East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank via a series of draconian measures. These have included illegally settling over 200,000 Israeli citizens in East Jerusalem in massive blocks that surround and cut the city off on the north, the east, and the south. They include erecting a huge complex of walls as part of a closure regime that has cut off Arab East Jerusalem from its West Bank hinterland. These settlements, these towering walls, and this regime, this closure regime, have given the most concrete possible meaning to the view attributed to Begin by the CIA analyst that, quote, East Jerusalem is not part of the West Bank. It has been made not part of the West Bank by these sets of actions. So I would conclude that this is therefore not just a list of Menachem Begin's intransigent and ideological positions, insisting on continued subjugation of the Palestinians to Israel's will and insisting on Israel's effective control over all parts of former mandatory Palestine. It's not just a Menachem Begin wish list. It is also an accurate description of every significant aspect of the regime that has been imposed in the occupied Palestinian territories since an interim self-government autonomy scheme was negotiated and implemented there in the 1990s. In fact, it serves as an accurate definition of the reality of the Palestinian Authority that was set up under Oslo. This memo, 1982 memo, summing up Begin's position, thus gives us a virtually perfect picture of the so-called Palestinian Authority, which has been with us now for nearly a decade and a half. An Israeli-devised and an Israeli-dominated regime like this, which guarantees the continuation of colonization and settlement, which guarantees Israeli military control, I think would most honestly be described not as a step toward self-determination or autonomy. It's most honestly, I think, described as a colonial regime. As they showed by their behavior during the fruitless autonomy negotiations, which dragged out over the subsequent years, from 78, really, into the early 1980s. Menachem Begin and his successor as prime minister, Yitzhak Shamir, were unwilling to agree with Egypt and the United States to grant the Palestinians even the less than half a loaf that Begin laid out at Camp David. They never would agree with the Egyptians on it. It took the popular uprising of the Palestinians living under occupation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, the so-called First Intifada from 1987 to 1991, and it took a subsequent change of Israeli government in 1992 to change this situation. The unarmed and largely, not entirely, but largely nonviolent Intifada clearly shook up the Israeli body politic. Eventually, it also affected Israeli leaders and forced them into a realization that the status quo of naked occupation was simply not sustainable. It convinced them that a new regime would have to be offered to the Palestinians. However, the regime that these Israeli leaders chose in the 1990s was in fact no more than one, as I've said, of veiled occupation and a colonial regime, exactly along the lines of Begin's autonomy plan. So what the Intifada did was force the Israelis to actually implement the plan that Begin had negotiated, but which was never implemented by him or by Shamir. Finally, and perhaps most strikingly, and this is where I come back to the United States, the extraordinarily low threshold that was promulgated by Begin for what the Palestinians would be allowed to obtain by their Israeli colonial masters has over time become the virtual ceiling of what American policymakers will allow or foresee for the Palestinians. This became the case over time, in spite of the discomfort of the CIA analyst who produced this memo. We could see this discomfort in his assertion that Begin's was not the only possible interpretation of Camp David. Other much more senior policymakers at the time and afterwards shared the same discomfort. You can read in William Quant's book, The Peace Process, someone who served under several American administrations, including Reagan, the degree of discomfort which American decision makers had with these restrictions. In practice, however, what has counted most since then was Begin's interpretation. This has become the fixed policy of the State of Israel under every subsequent government, and this is what counted, not the interpretations of Sadat or of Reagan or of later American or Egyptian presidents. In the end, all of them were obliged to acquiesce in this interpretation with good grace or with ill grace. This was true even of those presidents like Carter, Reagan himself, George H.W. Bush, President Clinton, and President Obama, all of whom initially appeared as if they might be inclined to take a more enlightened and less harshly restrictive position on Palestinian national rights than that of the Israeli government. Let me conclude by talking about what happened with the Reagan plan, talking about what happened to the Reagan plan. When the president finally promulgated his plan in a televised speech on the 1st of September 1982, a few days after this memo that I've read you parts of, the president offered the Palestinians little more than had Begin at Camp David. He referred to, quote, a just, this is the Reagan plan I'm quoting from now, the president's speech, while referring to a, quote, just solution of their claims, no mention of rights, at least in this stage, the Reagan plan balanced what he called legitimate rights against Israel's legitimate security concerns. So Palestinians had rights, but they were not absolute. They had to be balanced against Israeli security concerns. The term is in quotes. Now, Israeli security terms is another term of art. You have to understand, you know, there's security and there's security. There's ordinary security and there's Israeli security. This term has traditionally been a highly elastic wording used to cover a multitude of ever-expanding demands and requirements. The introduction of foreign armies into Jordan will not be allowed because it affects Israeli security concerns. Lebanon, there must be overflights of Lebanon, this affects Israeli security. So things that infringe on sovereignty of other states, things that include violations of international law, are carried out systematically and routinely because of Israeli security concerns. So Israeli security concerns are not ordinary security concerns. So when Reagan balanced Palestinian rights against Israeli security concerns, he was balancing something that the United States takes very seriously against something that is taken quite lightly by American policymakers. Reagan went on to state that he opposed, quote, Israeli sovereignty or permanent control over the West Bank and Gaza, unquote. But he also excluded, quote, the formation of an independent Palestinian state, and he insisted that, quote, self-government by the Palestinians in association with Jordan was the maximum they could hope for. Now, given this position, which was far below the minimum threshold of Palestinian demands for self-determination and statehood like every other people on earth, it's not surprising that the Reagan plan was unacceptable to the Palestinians, especially in the immediate aftermath of the PLO's traumatic defeat and evacuation from Beirut. In fact, much of the PLO leadership was on the high seas at this point, being evacuated from Beirut at the time the president gave his speech. Now, I'm going to digress briefly because I think it is important. I'm going to come back to this later. This was not the only way in which the Reagan administration had addressed the Palestinians at this time. There was another little-known episode, which I actually wrote about in a book many years ago. From June through August 1982, Ambassador Philip Habib had brokered the withdrawal, the evacuation, of PLO forces from Beirut, essentially facilitating the achievement of one of Sharon's major aims in the Lebanon War. This involved a lengthy series of indirect negotiations involving French diplomats, several Arab countries, and Lebanese leaders, Prime Minister Saeb Saddam, Shafi El-Wazen, many other people, over the PLO evacuation. In August 1982, the United States had finally sealed the deal by giving the Palestinians, giving the PLO, the guarantees for the safety of the Palestinian refugee camps that would remain behind in Beirut after the PLO's withdrawal. And the PLO had refused to withdraw unless it got these guarantees from the United States. So Habib offered explicit assurances that Palestinian non-combatants left behind after the PLO departed from Beirut would not be harmed and could live in, quote, peace and security. And the documentation is in the US State Department bulletin for that period. Obtaining these American assurances had been of utmost importance to Palestinian leaders who negotiated the PLO's departure. Because what was leaving was not just the PLO leadership, but the Palestinian forces who had previously protected these camps. They had good reason for their insistence on such guarantees in light of the ferocity of the Israeli assault on the city and the camps preceding and the camps bordering Beirut in the preceding 10 weeks. They were especially concerned, given the historical background of massacres of Palestinians and others in Karantina and Maslach in the eastern suburbs of Beirut and at the Dbaye and Tel Ezzata refugee camps in 1976 during the Lebanese Civil War. So with these things in mind, the PLO had demanded these assurances. In the event, massacres did take place. Hundreds of Palestinians and Lebanese civilians were slaughtered in Sabra and Shatila only a couple of weeks later in mid-September. That showed that these American assurances were utterly worthless. We're going to see next week that this wasn't the last time that critical U.S. assurances to the Palestinians were to prove to be unreliable. Let me go back to the Reagan plan. Notwithstanding the unacceptability of the Reagan plan to the Palestinians, it was also wholly unacceptable to Menachem Begin. It deviated from his desiderata in a number of crucial respects, and he made his views known. Regarding Israeli settlements, Reagan's speech called for a halt to their expansion and requested the immediate adoption of a settlement freeze. The president said this, although his administration had earlier been the first U.S. administration to cease describing Israeli settlements as illegal, which, by the way, was a change of position that had manifestly delighted Begin. We have a document which summarizes the last round of autonomy talks between Secretary Haig and Prime Minister Begin back in early 1982. And Begin is ecstatic over Reagan's change of position on the illegality of Israeli settlements. You can almost read the man's delight in his repeating, "The president has said this. This is finished. It's over." He's very, very pleased. So even though Reagan had said settlements are no longer illegal, he had called for a settlement halt, a settlement freeze, and stated further that the United States will not support their continuation as extraterritorial outposts. Now, this aroused the fury of Menachem Begin. All of these points angered them. They were particularly infuriated by Reagan's assertion that, quote, further settlement activity is in no way necessary for the security of Israel and only diminishes the confidence of the Arabs that a final outcome can be freely and fairly negotiated. Finally, the president proclaimed U.S. opposition to Israeli sovereignty or permanent control over the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Not surprisingly, given the divergences from the position of the Begin government, this plan provoked a firestorm of Israeli criticism. Begin was enraged that this thing had not been previously coordinated with Jerusalem, so he had a chance to basically bludgeon the Americans into accepting his position beforehand. Reagan had informed the Israeli Prime Minister that he was going to put forward a peace plan. He told him something about it, but he hadn't given it to him ahead of time so that he could edit it to his satisfaction. He was also angry that there had been consultations with Arab countries. Begin was not happy with this. He spared American leaders none of the self-righteous invective for which he was renowned. His sulfurous reply to the U.S. president, it's one of the most beautiful letters I've ever read, concluded with words from Isaiah 62, "For Zion's sake I will not hold my peace, and for Jerusalem's sake I will not rest." He was as good as his word. He made Reagan's life hell for a few weeks. A subsequent Israeli cabinet resolution summarily rejected the Reagan plan, detailing 7 points of irreconcilable difference with it. The U.S. initiative was thus stillborn. It was unacceptable to the Palestinians, but it foundered primarily on the rock of Begin's unyielding insistence on holding fast to every detail of his position. This was combined with the subsequent feebleness with which American policymakers defended their own positions and pushed back against Begin's intransigence. The Reagan plan thus sunk almost without a trace, except in the historical records that we have. The beauty of Begin's stance, as I think it was completely accurately summarized by this unnamed CIA analyst, is that it is straightforward and candid. You can say what you want about the man, but he was straightforward. More than 30 years on, and in the wake of that Israeli prime minister's ability to force both Presidents Carter and Reagan to back down, it should be clear that one ought to take Begin's positions very, very seriously. His assertion that the only kind of autonomy arrangements he or his successors would permit guarantee that under no condition can a Palestinian state be created is infinitely more honest than the disingenuous statements made since then by a procession of Israeli and American officials. In recent years, American presidents and Israeli prime ministers have asserted publicly their acceptance of a Palestinian state. Sotto voce, they have added crucial caveats and conditions. What they were actually and what they are actually referring when they talk about a Palestinian state amounts to a eunuch mini-state that meets Begin's restrictive definition and that ensures enduring bondage and denial of self-determination to the Palestinian people, whether in regard to control over land, control over water, control over security, the status of Jerusalem, the refugee issue, or any other major point of contention, the long-term regime envisioned and imposed on the ground in the West Bank and East Jerusalem by Israel is in its essentials exactly as described in the CIA compendium of the positions of Menachem Begin that I've just read to you. What is most striking is not that Begin, the father figure and icon of the Israeli right wing, which has now dominated Israeli politics for 35 years. What is striking is not that Begin should have in time come to define Israeli practice and much of Israeli discourse. I mean, it's his political heirs that have been in power for most of the past 35 years. What is really striking is that this line of action has in the end been acquiesced in and effectively supported by the United States. The United States has basically subscribed to the 1977 Likud Party platform. Whatever it says, in practice, Begin's notes for Camp David are a better guide to what American presidents actually do than the verbiage that they issue. This line of action, Begin's views, have come to define the bottom line of American policy, and again, what I call the infinitely low ceiling of what the United States envisages as allowable for the Palestinians. All of this is concealed by deceitful Orwellian verbiage, and I started last time with a quote from Orwell. We shall see in my third lecture next week how this line, Begin's line, became even more fixed in American policy during the Madrid-Washington negotiations of 1991-93. Thank you very much.